morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Resch. Counsel for the defense.
May I please the court? My name is Captain Richard Pizer, and together with Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Hendricks, we represent the appellant, Private Brandon M. Resch. A military judge bears the ultimate responsibility to ensure that an accused enters a known and a voluntary plea. The military judge is also the gatekeeper for the admission of evidence before the court. In this case, the military judge failed to ensure that Private Resch entered a known and voluntary plea. And then the military judge erroneously admitted evidence to the greater offense in violation of Private Resch's constitutional rights. Private Resch therefore requests that this court affirm only so much of the specification of charge one as finds the appellant guilty of AWOL from 11 April 2002 to 29 October 2002, and remand the case for a reassessment on the sentence. I'll begin by first addressing the provenance of the appellant's plea, and then move on to the improper use of the appellant's provenance inquiry statements, and if time permits, address the legal sufficiency of the evidence to both the greater offense of desertion and the greater period of leave absence. Appellant pled guilty to an absence without leave from 11 April 2002 through 22 January 2003. During the provenance inquiry, Robert Rush told the military judge that he contacted his recruiter in Michigan prior to 29 October 2002. He told the military judge that the recruiter was the middleman between himself and his company. He told the military judge that his recruiter had informed him that he had been dropped from the rolls and that he would not be able to return to any military branch or any U.S. service. These statements by the appellant raise a possible defense of termination by voluntary surrender. They suggest that the appellant presented himself to his recruiter.
Well, hang on. Did you say contacted or presented? And is there a difference?
No, the implication from his statements and when he says contacted is that he either did so personally or did it telephonically. The appellant would say it didn't.
So are you presenting yourself if you call someone from 1,000 miles away, for example?
Perhaps not, but in this case, we do not know whether he did call or whether he presented himself personally.
So, in your view, the record does not reflect, the record is silent on what it means to contact in this context.
Yes, Your Honor, and that gets to the heart of the issue in this brand of issue, because what has occurred is the appellant raised a possible defense, and once the appellant raised that possible defense, it was the military judge's obligation to conduct further inquiry into that possible defense.
Why is it a possible defense to say I called my recruiter?
Well, in this case, he didn't say he called his recruiter. He said contacted. And his recruiter was, in fact, in the same state in which the appellant was located. And his comments that the recruiter was a middleman suggested more than just a mere phone call. It suggested an ongoing contact between himself, the recruiter, and the company was actually occurring in this.
Is there any indication he called it more than once?
Other than the inference from the middleman role of the recruiter suggesting there was some ongoing contact, there was no further facts to that, Your Honor. But as this court stated in United States versus Felipe, even if the accused does not volunteer all the facts necessary to establish their defense, if he sets up a matter of raising a possible defense, the military judge is obligated to make further inquiry to resolve the ambiguity or the inconsistency.
Didn't the appellant Philippe present herself at a post or a base? Physically present herself?
I believe the facts were essentially similar to this. It was silent as to whether it was actually a personal presentation or telephonic. And the court.
Well, in Philippe, if I'm not mistaken, the appellant indicated that they appeared on base.
The appellant stated that
it wasn't resolved as to whether they did or not, but that's what the statement was.
That's correct, Your
Honor. Which on a spectrum between contact and presentment is further along towards presentment. So you have to deal with that distinction.
Well,
it doesn't mean you're right or you're wrong. You just have to deal with it and not
The similarities between this case and Philippe is that in Philippe, they were both in the same state of Montana. Here, they were both in the same state as Michigan. He had gone back to his hometown. It was the same town, presumably, from which he was recruited into the military and recruited being located.
But I thought in Philippe that he tried to turn himself in, and they said, this is an Air Force base. We don't take care of you. We can't do anything for you.
The actual facts in Philippe were that the Air Force informed him they did not see a warrant out for Philippe, and apparently he did not have a military ID, and they said there was nothing they can do for him.
But that's a little more than what happened in this case, isn't that correct?
Arguably so, Your Honor.
From the record we have here, I mean, we really don't know what happened. He just said he contacted him. We don't know whether he asked questions. We don't know whether he said, I want to turn myself in. None of that's in the record.
In this record, what we have is a conversation clearly between the recruiter and the appellant where they are discussing his absence without leave status. And it's clear from the context of the discussions that he references between himself and the recruiter. The recruiter actually gave him answers, which presumably come from questions from the appellant. Can I go back to my service? How do I do so? And the recruiter's response, taken in context, was what the appellant actually stated. You cannot return to a military branch or military service.
What's the effect of that alleged statement where the recruiter, who is a representative of the government, or at least was in the eyes of your client, said, basically, there's nothing you can do. And I think is the implication there that you're out, you don't have to do anything more?
That's a possible implication, but we're looking at this issue here, Your Honor. What we're looking at is what the military judge's responsibility was to receive that statement from the appellant. And what his responsibility was to clarify the record and make sure that appellant did not, in fact, raise the offense, and to elicit facts that would unambiguously negate that offense in this case. And here, the military judge's failure to conduct that inquiry and his very absence of those facts which this court is looking for is the substantial basis in law and fact for this court to question appellant's plea.
Counsel,
I guess I just have, aside from the providency aspects of this, it doesn't appear that you're raising any kind of a detrimental reliance argument at all. That this individual.
As far as that raised a defense of mistake of fact, no, Your Honor. As far as it raised a possible termination to appellant's AWOL prior to 29 October 2002, that was the relevant question the military judge should have been.
I understand that argument.
Facts.
What's the difference between mistake of fact and the termination of the AWOL at that point? If the individual reasonably relied upon the statement of the recruiter that he couldn't return anywhere.
It appears at that time that the appellant really didn't believe that statement because the military judge did conduct further questioning, and it appears to be in particular dealing with the mistake of fact offense. And that line of questioning led the appellant to provide the military judge with answers to the effect that once he was apprehended by civilian authorities, either the guards at that facility or other inmates had informed him that was not, in fact, the case. And he didn't have an honest and reasonable statement at that time.
And he did not at that time then turn himself into military authorities, did he?
After the 29th of October, when he was apprehended, no, he did not.
I'm missing something here. He may at some point have lost an honest and reasonable mistake fact defense to the entire period of AWOL when he learned through, I guess, the scholars at the prison what the real law was. But at the time that he called the recruiter, and if the recruiter had said to him at that point, you can't turn yourself in anywhere, why doesn't he have an honest and reasonable mistake of fact defense as to the termination period of the AWOL at that time?
And he may in fact have that, Your Honor, because that was his exact statement on the record was when the recruiter told him that, he did believe that.
So that the honest and reasonable mistake fact defense, while not applying to the entire period, may apply to where the termination point comes. So why don't you tell us, if the military judge had conducted a further inquiry, what dialogue would have taken place that would have given the military judge reason to not accept the plea?
Well, we certainly know that the military judge would have, if he was conducting a proper inquiry, instructed the appellant on what the nature of the law was to both defenses of mistake of fact and voluntary surrender. And once the appellant was instructed to what the nature of that law was, the military judge should have conducted the inquiry into the facts to determine if the facts either established that defense or if the facts did not establish that.
And what could the accused have said? And this will involve some speculation at this point, but I think we have to determine whether there is a reasonable likelihood that the accused would have made a statement which would have caused the military judge to not accept the plea. What type of statement would the accused have made under the facts of this case to bust the plea?
Well, it's entirely possible that I'm fully agreeing. The appellant may have stated that he did, in fact, personally present himself to the recruiter. But since the question was never asked, we do not know. And he also may have indicated why he was talking to that recruiter, besides just the recruiter's comments coming back, which is all we have. And it fleshed out whether he was actually contacting that recruiter in terms of getting back to his unit. And again, the suggestion is that is what the purpose of his contact with the recruiter was when he states that the recruiter was a middleman. Because that suggestion was some sort of coordination back to the company from which the appellant had absented himself.
Does mere contact with the recruiter, as opposed to presenting oneself for surrender, constitute a substantial, emphasis substantial, basis for questioning this plea? Remember, it's got to be substantial basis.
I think, and then if we look at the case in Felipe, the court actually used that analysis where the contact itself was the basis to say that there was not a substantial basis.
But again, in Felipe, the appellant presented himself or herself, or that's my recollection of the case. And there's no indication here that this appellant did so.
And going back into Felipe, I don't believe the record actually reflects that there was a definite answer of personal presentment. And that was just an inference drawn from the court because the appellant said he had gone to the Air Force Base. I guess that is sufficient to say there was a personal presentment to somebody.
Well, in Felipe, at page 311, the court goes through the three elements necessary for surrender, right? That a person presents himself to any military authority, notifies the authority of his unauthorized absence, and demonstrates a willingness to submit to military control. And then it goes through what the appellant says and how it matches up with those three, potentially matches up with those three elements. And what I don't see anywhere from what we have in this record is any suggestion that this appellant, even if he did more than simply call his recruiter, had any intention or expressed any desire to return himself to military control.
And the appellant's position is that, as in Felipe, the suggestion is here. The suggestion from his statements to the military judge is that he contacted his recruiter. We don't know if it was personal or through telephone.
But in Felipe, the appellant stated that he tried to turn himself in. Where do we have a statement anywhere near approaching that sort of fact in this case?
And we don't have that strong of a statement in this case, Your Honor. But when we look at the other two elements of that defense of voluntary surrender, we're looking at a willingness to submit to military control, and that he informed them of his unauthorized absence. In this case, the context of the conversation between himself and the recruiter was a discussion of his unauthorized absence and a discussion of returning military control, because the answers from the recruiter informed the appellant of his status and his ability to return.
Counsel, I think this is a little bit different from the answer that you gave before, although not necessarily inconsistent. As I understood your answer before, is that the statements that were made in the Providence inquiry create sort of a bookend. On the one hand, he says that he contacted the recruiter, which may not be enough on itself. On the other, at the end, he said, the recruiter told me that there's nothing I can do to return. And as I understood your argument, that then creates a responsibility on the military judge to ask further questions, because the latter statement, the statement there's nothing you can do to return to military control, suggests that there was a dialogue about returning to military control at that point that the military judge should have explored.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that is basically the appellant's argument, is that his statements are actually a trigger to the North Carolina judge's obligation to conduct a further inquiry. And without that further inquiry, this court, as in Felipe, cannot be confident that the unauthorized absence did not terminate prior to 29 October 2002, and therefore should only approve that short period of AWOL.
What's the implication of the confession, concession by the appellant at the Court of Criminal Appeals that his stipulation was not confessional and that the admission did not require a Bertelsen inquiry? If that wasn't a confessional stipulation, what's the problem of considering all of that then?
Well, that takes us to the second issue which I'd like to address with the court, which is the improper use of the province inquiry and the stipulation of fact to the greater offense of desertion for the additional period of time. And to answer your question directly, whether it's a confessional stipulation or not is not really relevant in this case, because during the province inquiry, the military judge had already conducted the care inquiry into the agreement of the parties and the understanding of the appellant to the use of his province inquiry and the use of the stipulation of fact. And having determined from the appellant's understanding that that province inquiry and the stipulation of fact would only be used to the offenses for which he was pleading guilty, the military judge decided to do the exact opposite.
Why wasn't that invited error, since his attorney urged the military judge to consider that information?
And that's not invited error in this case for the exact same reason, Your Honor. The military judge had advised the appellant that he was giving up his rights against self-incrimination and his right to a trial of the facts based upon evidence presented by the government only to the offenses to which he was pleading guilty. The military judge also established that all parties agreed that the proper inquiry and the stipulation of fact would be used solely to the offenses in which the appellant was pleading guilty in the sentencing. When the defense counsel stated that he believed it could be used and intended to use that, that itself was an inconsistency with the appellant's plea.
Well, but I mean, whether it's an inconsistency or not, not only did he say that he thought it could be used, in his closing argument he made reference to it. And the client stuck with what he said.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the fact of the matter is that these constitutional rights belong to the appellant, and it wasn't for his defense counsel to waive them, especially after the military judges already established what the appellant's understanding was. And when his counsel made that statement, the military judge again should have went back to appellant and made sure that appellant understood that when he made his plea, those statements he was making were going to be used against him to incriminate him again in the greater offense, and also to be used to relieve the burden of the government of its burden to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt through evidence that they must present.
Well, hasn't the Supreme Court ruled that in this particular situation, the client is stuck with the arguments that his attorney makes? I think in Murray versus Carrier, the Supreme Court rejected the argument that it was inappropriate to hold the defendant to the errors of his attorney.
And that may be the case, Your Honor, but the issue that we would like you to really consider here is that these are personal rights that belong to the appellant.
Are you saying you had to have the appellant, as opposed to his counsel, speaking to his counsel, had to personally say, "I waive them"? It sounds like waiver to me.
It's not in this case, because the military judge had already established during the care inquiry that appellant knew and understood that he was pleading guilty to a lesser period of AWOL.
Do you have any authority other than these Army Court of Criminal Appeals cases for the underlying proposition that you can't use this matter?
The only other cases, the cases obviously cited in the brief and the Air Force Service Court cases, Your Honor.
Yeah, there's an Air Force case and an Army case. Is that all the authority you have?
Yes, Your Honor.
We've never held one way or the other on the proposition.
I was unable to find any, Your Honor, so it appears to be a case of first impression at this court.
Well, what are the rules for courts martial say?
Well, the rules for court martial, in particular, rules 811, which deals particularly with stipulation of facts, and 910, which really addresses what the judge must address with the appellant during the care inquiry, really establish that the military judge must make a personal inquiry with the accused whenever he is discussing giving up these particular rights. And he must ensure that the accused understands any agreements that he may have with the government to the use of his statements. And in this case, the use of his statements was part of the agreement with the government. The stipulation of fact, the very language in it says, this will be used for the purposes of the offenses for which the accused is pleading guilty and for sentencing and on appeal.
Well, I'm trying to then figure out how we get to the constitutional error that you suggested earlier in light of, again, the defense concession at the Court of Criminal Appeals that there was not a confessional stipulation under Burleson. There may be a rule or statutory error here, but if the statements made during the plea inquiry were not confessional, the stipulation was not confessional, then how do you get to constitutional error?
The constitutional error comes from the fact that the waiver of the appellant to the use of the stipulation of fact in the statements during the violence inquiry was limited. And he understood the limited nature of that waiver when he made his initial care inquiry.
So were those statements confessional then?
And it's the appellant's position that it doesn't make a difference, because if you look at Burleson, Burleson requires you to do that inquiry if it's confessional. The problem here is the military judge has already done the inquiry under Burleson when he did the care inquiry.
Well, it might make a difference as to our standard of review whether the error is constitutional or not. If the statement's confessional, then we're dealing with constitutional error. If the statement's not confessional, and we're dealing with statutory regulatory error, then we're in a different posture as far as our standard of review.
And I understand that, Your Honor, but our position is still that he did not waive his rights against self-incrimination and to place the burden upon the government to prove his guilt of the greater offense beyond a reasonable doubt, when he agreed to the limited use of the stipulation of fact in the province inquiry.
If he didn't waive his right against self-incrimination, and the view, at least at the CCA, was that it wasn't an incriminating statement, where's the problem?
The problem is that the greater offense, the overwhelming evidence to the greater offense, is found only in the stipulation of fact in the province inquiry.
So that sounds to me like it's an incriminating, you're arguing now that it is an incriminating statement, contrary to the position that you all took at the Court of Criminal Appeals.
If I understand the nature of a confessional statement, the confessional would be if it had direct evidence of his guilt with regard to the intent. And in this case, there was no direct evidence in the fact that he didn't say he didn't intend to return to come back. But there certainly contained enough circumstantial evidence, and the government, in closing argument, relied almost exclusively on the stipulation of fact and the province inquiry statements of the appellant to argue the government's case. And in fact, the testimony of Captain Trotter, the only evidence put on by the government, was basically very weak and very minimal. Captain Trotter testified to a lack of knowledge regarding the appellant. He dithered upon the date in which he returned. He says, I want to say it was on 17 March. It was on or about that week. It was on Monday during that week. The direct evidence of the date and the circumstantial evidence of the intent all come from the province inquiry. And the trial counsel themselves believe that was where the evidence was coming from, and argue that both in the closing argument and in the rebuttal argument. And reference Captain Trotter in one or two sentences in the complete argument.
And the defense counsel argued it in his closing. Are you saying the defense can use this as a shield but not as a sword? Should it have been kept out on both sides?
It should have been kept out on both sides, Your Honor, because it was improper to use it for either purpose. And as the defense counsel himself said, when the discussion was going on between himself and the military judge, and again, the defense counsel was wrong, but the defense counsel said, if we can't use it for defense, then the government can't use it as a sword, to use your language. And of course, they were talking about the elements of the offense, and the counsel again got that wrong, because of course the court could use the common elements of the lesser and the greater offense. So the counsel was confused, the military judge was confused, and therefore the appellant certainly did not understand what he had waived with regards to his constitutional rights with the stipulation of fact.
Have you raised ineffective assistance of counsel in this case?
No, Your Honor, but the real issue here is the appellant's understanding, and the appellant's understanding was that he was waiving his rights solely to the offenses to which he was pleading guilty. He was not waiving them to the greater offense, and his counsel's statements otherwise are not inviting error or waiver, but are in fact a trigger, again, to the judge to go back to the appellant and say, we've already discussed this. You told me the understanding was we would not use this. And now your counsel's saying you're going to use it. Do you agree and understand what the court's going to do? And the court did not do that.
You have an opportunity on rebuttal to add to your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Captain Claire O'Shaughnessy, and along with Colonel John Miller, represent the government. The grant of the specified issues in this case can be consolidated into two focus areas, that of providence and legal sufficiency. A guilty plea is reviewed for a military judge's acceptance of a guilty plea is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. It takes a substantial basis in law and fact to overturn a guilty plea. In this case, appellant's contact with his recruiter did not terminate his absence because the military judge had the benefit of the stipulation of fact and appellant's statement and honed in on the critical element of military control. In order for appellant's contact with the recruiter to have constituted termination of his absence, appellant has to present himself to military authorities. He has to inform the military authorities as to his status, and then he has to submit or attempt to submit or demonstrate a willingness to submit to military control. The military judge specifically asked appellant, what did you do to return yourself to military control? To which appellant responded that he did not think, based on what he'd been told by the recruiter, that he had to, and that he went back to work. In order for appellant to avail himself of the mistake of fact defense,
that he had to or that he could?
That he had to. Okay. He said, I went back to work and like that. In order for appellant to avail himself of the mistake of fact as to his requirement to submit to military control, his belief has to be reasonable and honest.
So, what did this young man know about military law?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What did this young man know about military law at the time that he called the recruiter?
He had about 7 months total in the military, so what is clear that the judge did get from him is he knew how to request leave. Whether or not he's not going to be expected to know the elements that he's required to demonstrate to terminate his AWOL.
Right, and about how much time would we expect a recruiter to have in the armed forces?
Substantially more than the appellant. It would at least be an E5 or an E6. He would have to have had significant military experience to at least rise to the rank of a recruiter.
And so if, in a contested case, an accused with very little service said, I called the one person who I thought would know something about my situation, the recruiter, figured he was knowledgeable, an experienced person. And the recruiter told me, at this point, you're out of the military. You've been gone. The military needs to save money. They dropped you from the rolls. So they can go recruit somebody else. Why wouldn't that be an honest and reasonable mistake from the point of view of someone who's only been in the military for 7 months, at least for purposes of getting an instruction and letting the members decide whether it was honest and reasonable?
Your Honor, for purposes of getting an instruction, there has to be some evidence of the defense, and if he laid out the evidence as he had in this case, which said he had made contact with the recruiter, then that would be some evidence as to termination, such that he could get the mistake of fact defense at a contested trial. However, in this case, we don't have the fact that he presented himself, unlike the appellant in Philippi, who actually went to the base. We don't have that he informed them of his AWOL status. What we have is the recruiter's answer that he'd been dropped from the rolls.
And is his understanding as to what the effect of that is a mistake of fact, or is it a mistake of law? And does it matter?
It does matter, Your Honor, and as in order to it's the position raised by appellate defense counsel that it's a mistake of fact, in that if the circumstances had been as he believed them to be, which said he didn't, he was dropped from the rolls and he could not return to any branch, that would be a mistake of fact, such that if he were honestly believed it and were reasonable under all the circumstances, it would be a defense to his obligation to return in his mind. However, that's just not the case in this case, because he later informed the military judge that I was possibly AWOL when he told the informed the guards in the jail of his current status, that he was possibly AWOL, and he still had unresolved issues with the military. So clearly, even with only 7 months of experience in the Army, he had doubts about what he had been told. So while at the time that he heard that from the recruiter, he may have had, that may have been his understanding, he certainly did not have that understanding later.
Well, there's a misunderstanding as to his legal obligation, as to his military service, a mistake of law or a mistake of fact?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, I mean, I understand the appellant's argument that this was a mistake of fact, but aren't we, what we're talking about here is whether or not he had a legal obligation to return. Regardless of whether he knew about it or not, is this not based on a legal obligation?
It is ultimately based on his obligation to return, that is correct. However, in response to an earlier question, in that he called the one person he thought could help him with this, he could have called his company.
So do you agree this is a mistake of fact issue rather than a mistake of law issue, I guess?
I agree that it's a mistake of fact as okay. to his obligation, what he was obligated to do. He knew he couldn't leave without permission. He did know that.
Despite the fact that if it was a mistake of law, there would be no defense.
But if he didn't understand he had an obligation to return.
Do you understand what mistake of law?
I do understand what a mistake of, I just don't understand the how it fits in the context of this case.
Okay, whether someone has a legal obligation or doesn't have a legal obligation to return, would you agree that that's a legal question, not
a
factual
question?
And ultimately, isn't whether this person had to return to legal control that exact legal question? Irrespective of what someone told him or what he thought about it, isn't it a legal question whether he had to return to, whether he had a duty to return to military control? The fact you're dropped from the rolls, the fact that you've deserted, the fact that you've been gone for 5 years, does that affect legally your obligation to return to military control? Does it affect your status as being UA or in a deserter status?
I don't believe it does. He still had the duty to return. So I don't understand whether or not he knew about his duty to return is going to affect whether or not he was.
Well, a mistake of law is when an accused wrongly believes his conduct's legal when it's not legal. Is that the situation here?
No, it is not. The appellant understood that he had obligations to return because he told the guards in the jail, I had unresolved issues with the military and I was possibly AWOL. So even in his mind, he knew that he had some other dealings with the Army later, even after he talked to the recruiter. So I don't understand how that, he doesn't think he has an obligation to return and how that can help him.
If the recruiter told him, you don't have an obligation to return, at that point, he still has an obligation to return as a matter of law. Is that correct?
That's correct.
However, he may have a defense with respect to the termination date of an AWOL based upon whether that he presented himself and met all the tests. So at that point, are we dealing with an issue of law as to whether he had an obligation to return, or are we dealing with an issue of fact, that is, did he go through the steps necessary to raise the defense?
I believe we're dealing with an issue of fact, which is right. Whether or not he went through the necessary steps to return himself to military control. In his own mind, he had doubts about what the recruiter told him. That was evidenced by what he revealed to the judge later. Furthermore, Captain Trotter reported that he reported no contact with anyone associated with appellant, whether the recruiter was his middleman or not. Even if it was a valid mistake of fact that he could have availed himself, it only changes the date of the termination. It doesn't change the offense. It doesn't make him not guilty of AWOL. It's just for a lesser period of time, and it's still more than 30 days. as to the legal sufficiency of the charge of desertion. The guilty plea to the unauthorized absence, even if it's truncated based on the date that he contacted the recruiter, established the common elements to desertion. Once the common elements of the unauthorized absence were established, in order to prove desertion, the government had to put forth, and beyond reasonable doubt, evidence of his intent to remain away. The intent element can be established by circumstantial evidence, and in this case, circumstantial evidence that would lead a rational trier of fact to conclude that appellant had deserted his unit with the intent to remain away is supported by the distance that he was located from his unit. He went to Michigan.
Hang on. Let's argue this for the sake of argument alone, that the appellant is correct that the military judge is not in a position to rely on the stipulation of fact or the providence inquiry. Is that what you're doing, or?
Yes, okay. Your Honor, it's my position
but
that.
Then point out where you're drawing these things from.
Your Honor, the evidence that I'm relying on, the distance and the time and the information regarding other evidence from which emphasis can be drawn, it comes from the appellant's own sworn statement, which was attached to the stipulation of fact. And it can be considered by the military judge. Because once a stipulation of fact has been agreed to by the parties and not withdrawn or disavowed, those are the facts before the court-martial.
But I think Judge Baker is asking you, assuming that the appellant is correct and that we can't consider the providency inquiry or the stipulation of fact, where are you getting the facts that you're relying on for circumstantial evidence of desertion? And if I'm misspeaking, forgive me, Judge Baker.
Thank you.
The only other... Assuming that the stipulation of fact and the sworn statement cannot be considered by the military judge as independent proof of the element of intent, the only evidence before the military judge would have been the testimony of Captain Trotter. And he testified that he hadn't heard from appellant, hadn't heard from any member of his family, hadn't heard from anyone on his behalf, that he no longer had any personal items in the company area, but later conceded that they may have been returned to the appellant from somebody else working in supply, but that he'd never heard of this person, never laid eyes on him until he showed up in his formation.
But he'd only been there since October of the previous year, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. He'd been there. He testified he took over command on the 18th of October.
So the parties at least agree that the only evidence that's independent of the stipulation, all it is in debate, is Captain Trotter.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
What is the government's position as the underlying legal argument advanced by the appellant on the use of the stip? And
well, Your Honor, if I understand the argument correctly, the basis for not using the stipulation of fact is essentially a contract claim that this was not one of the uses that was contracted for based on the pretrial agreement that it could be used for, and the military judge went over that in the beginning and asked him, do you understand that you're only waiving your rights with respect to the charges to which you're pleading guilty, nothing about any charges to which you're pleading not guilty. I understand that that's the basis of the argument, that therefore the stipulation and the sworn statement couldn't be used. But I would point out that this was a judge-alone trial, wasn't contested, wasn't a panel case, and the military, I guess essentially what you would be asking the trial counsel to do would then be to ask the judge to admit the sworn statement independent as a separate exhibit.
But isn't it relevant what the judge has told the accused as to what he is giving up? The judge may be right or wrong, but that's still the accused's understanding of what the playing field looks like.
That is true. That is what the military judge told him, that this would only be used for these purposes. However, as to the issue of the constitutional dimension of his right not to incriminate himself, on the very cover page of the sworn statement, the appellant had already waived his right not to incriminate himself in writing before he rendered the statement, and the charge at that time, as laid out by at least the CID agent, was desertion. So we've been put on notice at least once of what that is. He had a right not to make that statement. However, he chose to waive those rights and then issued the statement.
So the government's argument is basically waiver.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So if you make a statement, you waive your right against self-incrimination, and then, as part of a pretrial agreement, you're assured that that statement won't be used against you. That is, then there's no reason to contest the voluntariness or validity of the statement. Why does that waiver apply through trial when you've been assured that it won't be used against you?
You know, I guess the problem is if you have to step back and look at it in the context of this case, the reason that the defense counsel at trial asked the military judge to, one, consider the statements made during pregnancy and to consider the stipulation.
Now, let's talk about the general issue, not whether the defense counsel waived it, but the issue of whether a stipulation can be used on the merits of trial when the accused has been assured that the stipulation in the associate statements won't be used against the individual. Why can't the individual at that point say, I have no reason to contest anything about this statement because I've been assured that it won't be used against me on trial on the merits on the greater offense?
Your Honor, the court addressed some of those issues in the Bertelson case such that what's the point of pleading not guilty for desertion if you're then going to just turn over the statements that are going to be the effect of a guilty plea, such that, you know, what rights do you preserve by pleading not guilty to the desertion? And the court held in that case that the further inquiry and the affirmative waiver from appellant himself, that before these statements are then admitted into evidence, that the judge would have to get a head nod or affirmative yes from appellant himself, such that another care-type inquiry would have, or a bulletin inquiry would have to be conducted, goes to the nature of what's actually in the stipulation and whether or not it's confessional. And in this case, it's not a confessional stipulation. And as I was alluding to earlier, the reason these documents came in without an objection, they came in by affirmative request because there was nothing in the statements that was going to hurt appellant as to the issue of intent to remain away permanently. In both his province inquiry statements and in his sworn statement, he had evidence that would be contrary to the government's position.
That may go to harmless error. I'm just going to the question right now of error. Can a military judge tell an accused during a providency inquiry that your statements during this providency inquiry and the stipulation that you enter and any attachments made to it cannot be used against you? Can the military judge say that and then turn around and admit those items or consider them on the merits of trial, having told the accused that they won't be considered?
No, the case law that addresses this issue says that another inquiry should be conducted. That says that the military judge should ask the appellant before he just bowls over and considers these evidence. He should inquire of the appellant himself.
So in this case, putting aside the question of whether the defense waived this by the defense counsel's affirmative use of the material later, would the military judge have erred by not conducting that inquiry before using those statements on the merits against the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
It was error, but it's the opposition that it's harmless.
Counsel, what's the government's position on the underlying rule that the appellant is urging from the Raymeld case and the Air Force case?
The position is that while normally the state...
Do you agree or disagree with the rule, first of all?
I agree with the rule that the statements made in support of a plea should not be used for an offense to which you pled not guilty because you pled not guilty, so your own statement shouldn't be used against you. However, in this case, it's not as though the government were trying to get these statements in as substantive evidence. This was the appellant's counsel asking the judge to consider that because appellant made the statement that I didn't intend to remain away.
So under the rule, they shouldn't have been allowed, but here you're relying on invited error.
That's correct, Your Honor, the fact that even if it were error, it was harmless because of the statements that he made. Even before this court, as to the element of intent to remain away permanently, appellant has relied on the sworn statement that's attached to stipulation of fact, has referred to information in that. So while he shouldn't be allowed to put forth a defense, you know, in the sense that the government can't use that as substantive evidence, it's either we both get to use it or nobody gets to use it. And I think this was alluded to earlier as both the shield and the sword.
Let me ask you this question, counsel. If, in fact, we don't accept the stipulation of fact or the accused statement that's contained within it, and the only thing that we have is Captain Trotter's testimony, do you believe that there's legally sufficient evidence of an intent to remain away permanently?
Your Honor, I think at the end of the day what we have is an unauthorized absence of some period.
Thank you.
Because without the sworn statement of stipulation of fact, there's insufficient evidence. We only have the lesser, we have the common elements to desertion, and evidence as to intent is not there. Subject to your further questions, I'd like to briefly conclude. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in accepting appellant's plea of guilty to unauthorized absence because appellant's contact with his recruiter did not terminate his absence, and the military judge resolved this factual inconsistency. Furthermore, the evidence is legally sufficient to support a finding that appellant deserted his unit with the intent to remain away permanently. This court should affirm the findings and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the defense.
The military judge had the obligation to ensure the appellant entered a knowing and voluntary plea. He had an obligation to make sure the appellant understood his agreement with the government and the uses of the stipulation of fact in his province report. And the judge did, in fact, do that. And it was not invited error when this counsel stated that he intended to do something different, or he believed something different can occur because of the argument established by the military judge with the appellant that it would not occur.
In the absence of a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, why isn't it counsel's authority to determine, if we're not dealing with a confessional stipulation, why isn't it counsel's authority to determine how best to proceed with the presentation of evidence at trial?
Because in this case, besides just the agreement there, whether they're confessional or not, those statements by the appellant are admissions which are self-incriminatory. They may not amount to a full and complete confession under Barbasol, but they are incriminating statements by the appellant, and he had a limited waiver of that right against self-incrimination in his guilty plea.
Well, now are you saying it is confessional? We've gone back and forth about this.
Again, we're not saying it's confessional because it's not a direct statement of I have the intent to remain away permanently. But the facts contained therein are circumstantial evidence, and there are certainly admissions that the court can use to infer an intent. And as such, they are self-incriminatory statements. In this case, what happened is, clearly, the appellant had a mistake of fact. And the appellant didn't realize his legal obligations to return to military authority or not, and he was relying on other people to do so. And he was relying upon the military judge or the court-martial to ensure that he understood, and in fact, the manual for court-martial demands under Article 45 that the military judge has the obligation to ensure the appellant understands what he's pleading to, what he's waiving, and what he's giving up when he enters that plea. In this case, the appellant, who only had a GED education, clearly didn't understand what was going on. And when his defense counsel went up and made a statement contrary to everything he'd been told prior to that point in trial, the appellant sat there mute. And the military judge did not clarify that the appellant understood that he was going to, in fact, use his statements to a greater capacity than he either waived or that he agreed with the convening authority. And in this case, it's only if the court presumes that the military judge correctly applied the law and knew the law, contrary to his statements in the record and the other evidence in the record to the contrary, that we get to a legal sufficiency analysis. And in that case, it would be, as this court suggests, only the testimony of Captain Trotter to support the greater offense. And a Professional trier of fact would like to know those things that Captain Trotter didn't know. He didn't know how far away the appellant was from his unit. He didn't know how long he was down because he never knew what the guy until he arrived. He didn't know where he was. He didn't know if he got a job. He didn't know if he had destroyed his military uniform. He didn't know what happened to his property. But even as to the greater date, Captain Trotter's testimony is, I want to say it was on the 17th of March. It was during the week. It may have been a Monday. He didn't know the exact date. And in Russia, trier of fact, would want to know, where is the standard form 4187 that you fill out when you have a soldier return? What did you do, Captain Trotter, to document his return? And in this case, none of that evidence is present, and Captain Trotter's evidence is minimal at best, and on a legal sufficiency analysis, it would fail. The bottom line in this case, Your Honor, is the military judge had an obligation to ensure that Private Russian had a knowing and voluntary plea. He did not do so. He also erroneously admitted evidence to the greater offense in violation of Private Russian's constitutional rights, and this court should only affirm so much of the sentence as finds the appellant guilty of an AWOL from 11 April 2002 to 29 October 2002 and remand the case for reassessment on the sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. The court will stand in recess until 5 minutes before 10 o'clock.
Stands in recess for 5 minutes.
Our second case this morning is United States against Brown. This case is set for 15 minutes per side. Counsel for the defense.
Thank you. May it please the court, Chief Judge Efron, honorable judges of the court, good morning. Captain Christopher Ferretti. Together with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, they represent the appellant in this case, Senior Airman Kevin Brown. The added issue in this case is whether appellant's contingent declaration constitutes communicating a threat. At trial, the government charged the offense at issue as, quote, wrongfully communicating a threat to kill Staff Sergeant Autumn R. Silvers. Although the government did not charge this as a diverse offense, there are two statements at issue here by my client. The first was, as testified to by Sergeant Silvers, he, my client, said that if I wasn't his baby's mother, that he would kill me too. And the second statement, he said, if my son wasn't there, I would be dead. This honorable court examined a similar issue raised in United States versus Phillips and answered the question whether a rational fact finder, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, could find beyond a reasonable doubt that appellant's language constituted a threat. The Phillips court broke down its analysis along the following lines. First, the court considered that the term threat connotes an avowed present determination or intent to injure presently or in the future. Second, communicating a threat is not a specific intent crime, but one must consider the language of the communication and all the circumstances surrounding it. And breaking that down further, the intent which establishes that the offense is that expressed in the language of the declaration, not the intent locked in the mind of the declarant. So we're not solely focused on what's going on in my client's mind. It doesn't change the elements of the offense, and that's from United States versus Galulli, quoting United States versus Humphrey.
Are you arguing, therefore, that if a lawyer after the fact can read words to suggest a contingency, that can never constitute a threat? Are you trying to make Shropshire some of the language there, but you have to choose which language you're going to choose, is QED definitive?
Well, Your Honor, I think the actual statement on its face can certainly indicate a threat, but there are, as the case law has shown, other factors that the court must consider.
So you're saying it's contextual. You're not trying to get us to, write an opinion that says under the elements of the offense, any threat that contains a form of contingency can never constitute an offense?
I would say it's contextual, yeah.
Okay.
And a what the court can consider is, in fact, my client's true intention, if that can be discerned, the understanding of the person to whom the statement is communicated, and that in this case that was Sergeant Silvers, and also the surrounding circumstances. And these factors then...
Do the surrounding circumstances include a matter of which he was acquitted at trial, like allegedly choking her, like allegedly hitting her upside the head?
I would argue yes, Your Honor.
Okay, we can consider that,
yes,
even though he was acquitted of it.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
These factors can reveal the statements to be made in mere jest or idle banter, and that language. It's also been described as mere talk or jest in United States versus Nicholas. And the third thing that was set out in the Phillips opinion, the court in Phillips referenced United States versus Shropshire and set forth the proposition that the existence of a threat should be evaluated from the point of view of the reasonable person. And importantly, appellant requests that this court consider Shropshire, certainly, because in Shropshire, the court found that the words uttered by the appellant expressed a contingency that neutralized the declaration, since there was not a reasonable possibility the uncertain event would happen. That, we believe, is the case here as well in United States versus Brown.
Well, with a reasonable person, you just said that we can consider the fact, the allegation of which he was acquitted. He choked her twice. He hit her on the head. They engaged in, shall we say, a significant amount of personal violence. Wouldn't a reasonable person looking at this statement in that context, couldn't a reasonable person looking at this statement in that context conclude that it was a threat, that he was in fact communicating a threat?
We would argue no, Your Honor. And I think in addition to just the fact that there was evidence presented at trial from primarily from Sergeant Silvers, but the court can also consider that Sergeant Airman Brown testified in many cases that a lot of those events didn't happen, and in fact he was acquitted, so mm-hmm. The court can consider the fact that he was acquitted. And in Shropshire, the court actually noted the difference between saying, when I get this restraining gear off, I will show you what I will do, and if you take this restraining gear off, and therefore stating, concluding that, so with a slight variation, the words uttered could in fact produce a threat. So applying the Phillips analysis to this case, first of all, the appellant agrees with the Court of Criminal Appeals and its application of Shropshire with respect to his first statement. Again, that statement being, he said if I wasn't his baby's mother, that he would kill me too. And the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals relied upon the proposition that this alleged threat was conditioned upon a variable that could not occur. Therefore, the condition negated the threat. However, appellant does disagree with the Court of Criminal Appeals' conclusion that the second statement was a threat.
Sorry, but going back to that period, or therefore, the person who heard that would not have felt threatened. It goes back to whether you're looking for a black letter rule or a contextual rule.
Yes, sir.
Well, you said you agreed with the CCA, but the CCA stopped when it said the contingency could not have occurred. They didn't then go on to say, and therefore, a reasonable listener or this particular listener would not have felt threatened. They just said, they just stopped, as if that could never be a threat. But if I understand you correctly, you're not saying it could never be a threat, it just wasn't in the context presented here.
I'm not saying that it could never be a threat.
So you don't fully agree with that? It's not a trick. I'm not trying to get you to beat up on the CCA, which you're appearing before next week.
Thank you.
But I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying when you say you agree with the CCA, because the CCA arguably stopped in mid-sentence.
We agree with the result that first statement should not have been considered communicating a threat.
By the way, when you're looking at it contextually, are we looking at subjective, objective, or reasonable person into how we should, or all of the above, because it's contextual? Thank you.
I would argue all of the above, Your Honor. And I believe the subjective is obvious, clearly what Sergeant Silvers testified to, and Senior Airman Brown for that matter. Objectively, that is, I believe, what's referenced in paragraph 110C of that offense in the ECMJ. It's been referred to as the objective approach. It does reference essentially our argument here today that he negated the threat as he made it. And yes, subjective and reasonable person, yes.
Well, counsel, Judge Baker, are you finished?
Yeah. Thanks.
In terms of context, what do we then make of the first statement? Assuming that we have an appellate acquittal here from the court below as to that particular statement, is there any reason to not consider that first statement, if I wasn't the baby's mother, et cetera, for its bearing on the second? And that is there anything in the trial itself or the decision of the Court of Criminal Appeals that would lead us to discount that statement for purposes of establishing a threatening context and atmosphere?
Yeah, the appellate specifically asked this court to consider that first statement in context with the second statement.
Why doesn't that work against you then? That is, even if the statement doesn't meet our legal definition of communicating a threat, why wouldn't a reasonable person hearing that statement begin to apprehend for her own safety?
Well, Your Honor, put into context, basically, and this is in addition to what's been briefed on paper, essentially our argument is that first statement is conditioned upon a variable that essentially cannot occur, and also the second statement is along those same, can be viewed along the same lines.
I don't think I'm making my question clear. I'm not questioning whether, as a matter of law, the first statement is communicating a threat under Article 134. Assuming that it is not, why is it nonetheless unreasonable for a court to rely on that statement for purposes of establishing a threatening atmosphere and context in which all the other statements would be said? That is, if a person hears, well, I'm not the baby's mother, is a person say, oh, therefore I don't have to worry about anything else that's being said here? Or is a person at that point get very apprehensive about her safety with the idea of, yeah, I am the baby's mother, so maybe this is a contingent threat, but this person is very upset with me now to the point of talking about killing? Any indication that that's a joke at that point, or humorous, or not something to be taken seriously, even if not a legal threat?
Along those lines, Your Honor, absolutely. It is in that context. I would characterize it as more along the lines of idle banter, that he's just running his mouth, and that she shouldn't take it seriously. And getting along, okay, moving along then to the second statement, I was getting to the point that there are two arguments we were trying to make. One is in the brief, and that I would say is my alternative argument. I don't have...
Counsel, if you want to take time off of your rebuttal now, or you can save it for rebuttal, I'll give you a choice as to how most effectively you want to present that point.
I could just use an extra minute here.
Sure.
I just wanted to point out along those lines with respect to the second statement, in addition to what's in the brief, we would also argue that that is, in effect, a condition upon a variable that could not occur because of its ambiguity. And everyone to this point has assumed that the appellant, including appellant's counsel, has assumed that he is referring to the presence of the baby in the room, when in fact he could be simply musing about how he regrets being in this relationship with Sergeant Silvers to begin with. He wishes never had a child with her. And again, that when placed in context with that first statement, it makes sense. And we would argue, those are reasonable interpretations of the appellant's statement, both conditioned upon variables that could not occur. And if there are no further questions now, I'll just save the rest for
you. Okay. You have an opportunity on rebuttal. Less than 1 minute. Thank you for your argument. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, I am Captain Nicole Wishart, and together with Major Matthew Ward, we represent the United States. The appellant communicated a threat when he told Staff Sergeant Autumn Silver that if she was not his baby's mother, he would kill her, and if her son was not there, then she would be dead. The key issue in this case is whether appellant's threats contained an impossible condition that negated the threat's intent.
Do we have one threat here expressed in different ways or multiple threats?
Your Honor, that's two different ways to look at it. You can look at it as two separate threats because they were said in different times with different variables within them, or you can look at it, again, going to the context of the circumstance in that the overall declared intent was to kill Sergeant Silvers. This honorable court should affirm the findings and sentence for three reasons. First, the facts. Based on appellant's language used and all of the circumstances, any conditions in appellant's threats were events that were reasonably likely to occur. Second, the analysis used in U.S. v. Phillips and U.S. v. Alford is applicable here to affirm appellant's conviction. Third, even assuming for argument's sake that the threats contained a condition that was impossible to fulfill, appellant's language amounts to provoking words under Article 117 of the UCMJ, which is an LIO of communicating a threat.
Do you think that your arguments are equally as strong with respect to both statements?
No, Your Honor. The United States recognizes that Sergeant Silvers is the mother of the baby. However, the distinction there is that the appellant and that of the lower court was focused on maternity rather than paternity. And we know from the record that the relationship was turbulent. They often they got into fights and he became physically and verbally abusive with Sergeant Silvers based on paternity issues and whether she was having sexual relationships with other people as well as himself.
But he didn't say, if I wasn't the baby's father. He said, if you weren't the baby's mother. There was no question that she was the baby's mother.
Right, but the language used by the appellant was, if you were not my baby's mother, which is different than if you were not the baby's mother.
But you agree that that statement, that you have weaker ground to stand upon with respect to that statement.
Are both statements before this court?
Your Honor, I would argue that they were. And the law of the doctrine is...
So you're saying, what did the CCA do then when it said we agree with the appellant on the first threat at least?
I believe that the CCA was
Did they get the law wrong? Is that what you're saying?
We challenged the analysis. Yes.
Did you all appeal it? Did you certify that issue?
No, Your Honor.
So are you allowed, is it appropriate for you to come up here now and argue the first statement rather than the second?
First, Your Honor, appellant again raised it in his brief, so it would be manifest injustice for us not to be able to address it. Second, the law of the case doctrine is not binding on this court. But nevertheless, you don't need to reach that decision because we do have the stronger argument with the second threat, and that's where my analysis is focused during the argument.
Where did the appellant raise the first other than noting that the court below, did the appellant raise the validity of the decision on that first threat?
The appellant went into the analysis of U.S. v. Gately, which the United States is completely distinguishable from the facts in this case. So in the brief, by briefing it, the appellant did raise it before this court, and you should be able to address it.
But no one's challenged it, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. That's correct.
And under the law of the case doctrine, under the standards of the law of the case doctrine, what allows you to now challenge the decision of the court below? What are the standards and how do you meet them?
Your Honor, I would just submit that that it's not binding, it's doctrine, and I can move on and focus on the second threat because this court doesn't need to reach
that decision. Okay, if you prefer not to answer my question, we'll take that as an answer.
Thank you, Your Honor.
On the law, if I'm not mistaken, do you agree with the appellant that the analysis is contextual? That's what I heard in your opening salvo.
That it's contextual. That just because a condition may be in the language of a threat, that does not automatically rule it negated, the intent to be negated. You can find communication of a threat even if there is a condition within that language, so long as there is a reasonable possibility that the uncertain event could occur.
Well, you say that was one of your contextual factors. So is the government position that if there's no possibility the event could occur, you could never have a threat?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor? Are you arguing that if there's no possibility the event could occur, then there could never be a threat? Is that the government, what the government's presenting here? That's what I heard you to say.
There needs to be a reasonable possibility that the threat could occur. Yes, Your Honor. And here, the facts show that there is a reasonable possibility that the threats could occur.
So, if a drunken 40-year-old man is running around threatening someone and says, "You're lucky I'm not 20, I'd kill you," the drunken 40-year-old man will never be 20. Therefore, there can be no possibility that he's threatening anyone.
The facts of that circumstances, because if the recipient...
But you just said there had to be a reasonable likelihood that the contingency would occur.
Yes, sir.
In that context, there's no likelihood the contingency will occur.
So,
is the government reconsidering what its framework is or not?
I am, Your Honor, because what you do need to look at is also the reaction of the recipient who is receiving the threat. And so if there is always that bright line test that if the condition was impossible, then there would be no need to look at the subjective reaction of the person receiving the threat. Looking at the facts of this case, we know that the appellant had a prior violent history with Sergeant Silvers in September of 2002. In October of 2003, in March of 2004, as well as the night that the threats were made, in the 24th and early morning hours of the 25th of April 2004. The appellant became violent both before and after the threats during the fight, which lasted several hours. He became violent both with the baby in the room while Sergeant Summers was holding the baby, and also when the baby was in another room. Sergeant Silver's reaction to the threat is also telling. She testified, "I was scared to death. He had already put his hands around my neck twice that night, and he'd never threatened to kill me before." And that's in the record at page 144.
Wasn't he acquitted of that?
Yes, Your Honor, but again, going to the contextual circumstances, this is certainly a factor that should be considered.
Well, if he's acquitted of the conduct, doesn't that mean that the court determined that it wasn't sufficient? How can we now consider that as a fact if it wasn't found below?
Your Honor, I would submit that every fact before the fact finder need not be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Rather, the evidence should be reviewed by the fact finder, all of the evidence, all of the testimony, all of the factors, to then determine whether the offense is proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So within this law, looking at all of the surrounding circumstances, that should be a factor that may be considered by this court.
This was charged in a single specification, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
That he communicated a threat on such and such a date.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the evidence seemed to split three ways. There were the two threats we're talking about today, and then a threat against another unnamed individual, which is out of the picture. Can we know on what basis he was convicted? Threat one, threat two, both of them. Is there a Walters issue here?
Your Honor, there is no Walters-Sutters issue here because the Walters-Sutters line of cases shows there needs to be some indication that he was acquitted of one of the offenses. This is not charged in a diverse specification.
No, it wasn't charged in a diverse specification, but could the CCA know on which on the basis of one, on the basis of the other, on the basis of no, of both what he was convicted of?
May well have been convicted of both statements.
He may very well have been.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So is your position there is no Walters issue here?
There is not, because the Walters issue only goes to those where there is indication of acquittal on one before the fact finders. I would point your attention to U.S. v. Phillips, in which case the court found and noted that although perhaps the victim in that case may have not been inclined to discuss the matter of an affair, that was the issue in the case, a threat regarding an affair, there was no reason proffered but for the threat that would have prevented her from reporting the incident to others or discussing it among her friends. Likewise here, there's no reason which would have prevented Sergeant Silvers or the baby from going into another room. Additionally, in U.S. v. Alford, the court noted that the appellant had no right to impose a condition on the victim reporting his misconduct. An imposition of a wrongful condition does not negate the present determination to injure. And there was no reasonable possibility in that case that the prisoner would report an assault by a fellow inmate to the guard because the guards are reasonably accessible. Similarly here, appellant had no right to place a condition on Sergeant Silvers that she forever remain with her baby. There were three people who could have made that uncertain event become reasonable. One, appellant could have removed the baby. Appellant could have forced Sergeant Silvers to another part of the room. Sergeant Silvers could have removed the baby to another room for a called a friend to pick him up for the fear of safety of the son. Or the baby, who would have been 9 or 10 months in April of 2004, could have crawled or walked to a different location of the apartment. And this case is certainly distinguishable from U.S. v. Shropshire. In Shropshire, the court noted that, this was threat regarding the appellant said, I have more muscle in my little finger than you have in your whole body, and if you take this restraining gear off, I'll show you what I can do. He was talking to a guard in a confinement facility. The court there found that the threat depended on the guard doing something that he should not do, that is, removing the restraining gear. Also,
but didn't they think that he should not do that because if he did, he would come to harm based on what the person had just threatened?
That was part of it, and the analysis there was the threat was directed at that guard, so the guard had control of the uncertain event becoming fulfilled, whereas here, Sergeant Silvers was not solely in control of overcoming the event, because appellant could have, Sergeant Silvers could have, or the baby could have moved within their own volition. And I think it is noteworthy that in the context of that case, this is an appellant who is confined for a presumably good reason, and there would be no reason for that guard to take the restraining gear off at that time because it was something that the guard should not do. He was restrained for a reason.
But I mean, what the court specifically said is that it was not doing something that he... I'm sorry. Never mind. Go ahead.
This case is also distinguishable from Gateway. In that case, the appellant stated, if this were the civilian world, I'd take my 357 Magnum and shoot the victim 6 times between the eyes. Because the accused was on active duty, the court found that that was an uncertain event that could not occur. Again, we have many reasonably possible situations that could have made the uncertain event be fulfilled. Alternatively, even assuming for argument's sake that appellant's threats contained contingencies that could not occur, appellant's language constituted provoking words under Article 117, which is an LIO of communicating a threat. In Gately, even though they found no threat was communicated, they affirmed the modified finding based on this LIO, provoking words, because the language used was likely to induce the breach of peace. Appellant communicated threats when he told Sergeant Silvers that if she wasn't his baby's mother, he would kill her, and if her son wasn't there, then she would be dead. To the extent that appellant's threats contained any contingencies, in both circumstances, the condition for the threat was reasonably possible, and appellant's threat was not negated. Alternatively, even assuming if the threats contained an impossible condition, this honorable court should affirm the findings under Article 117, provoking speech. If there are no further questions, in conclusion, the United States urges this honorable court to affirm the findings and the sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
I'd just like to make a couple of points in rebuttal. Something I wanted to mention initially, with respect to the second statement, his second statement does not unambiguously constitute a declaration of an existing determination, purpose, or intention to carry out the threat presently or in the future. And I just wanted to highlight that part of appellant's argument regarding ambiguity, and we would argue that there is a certain amount of ambiguity in the way he conveyed these statements to Sergeant Silver. Appellant would also note that both statements use the word would, and that's getting very down into the weeds. However, we do believe that that's important in a case like this, and as was the case in United States versus Cotton, the court described the word would as antithetical to a present determination to harm another. That's the appellant in this case used would in both statements. And it also bears mentioning that appellant's statement, the second statement again, does not reflect a future intent. As in, had he said...
It sounds a little bit like people need to have lawyers with them at all times to figure out whether they're being threatened or not.
That's what I was thinking.
Is that really your position? Or is your position that it's contextual and these are all factors that play into the context?
Again, Your Honor, it is contextual. These are just factors that I wanted to mention. And again,
is it subjective based on whether the person who hears the threat feels threatened?
I would argue not entirely, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, how is it subjective at all? So someone comes and says, you know, something that, you know, would sound very threatening, but, you know, I think I'm really tough and so I'm not afraid. Does that mean that legally they didn't communicate a threat? If I come into court and say, well, I didn't feel threatened at all, even though they said that they were going to chop me up into little pieces and dismember me and they held a bloody knife in their hand when they said it?
I would have to, again, say, Your Honor, that it would have to be considered in context. And certainly in a case like that, that is something that would have to be taken into consideration by the fact finder, that subjective impression of what was threatened. So in conclusion, judges of this honorable court, the contingencies expressed by Senior Airman Brown negated the existence of a possible threat in both statements. Based upon his language and the surrounding circumstances, his remarks are not criminal. Rather, they reflect a crude means of expressing his frustration with his relationship with Sergeant Silvers. For these reasons, appellant respectfully asks this court to set aside the findings of appeal as to specification 1 of charge 3. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, and thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The court will stand in recess until 10:30.
Major Ayers,
how much time do you want to reserve for the bill?
12 and 3.
Our third case this morning is United States against Alvage. The case is set for 15 minutes. Counsel for the defense.
Good morning. May it please the court. BS crap personal agenda. Originally used by Major Melcher in widely disseminated emails which illustrate his bias against Ahmad Alvage, Sergeant Alvage's brother. Sufficient evidence establishes that Nathan Melcher should not have served on appellant's court-martial panel based on his bias, whether actual or implied, or not about. And as a result, appellant's constitutional and regulatory right to a fair and impartial trial was violated. First, Major Melcher lied on voir dire. He was actually biased against Ahmad Alvage.
Counsel, we had a debate on this thing, and a senior military judge looked at the credibility and made explicit findings of the credibility of the people involved. Why should we disturb those findings?
You should disturb those findings because they are clearly erroneous, Your Honor. And the evidence established during the debate hearing shows that. First, when asked during group voir dire, the military judge asked, does anyone know anyone named Ahmad Alvage in the specifications? All court-martial panel members answered no. Major Melcher's answer, however, was a lie. And even if it's not a lie, his claim is unlikely based on the evidence deduced.
So here's a question. I think it's a follow-up on Judge Stuckey's question, which is the person at issue says that they weren't, basically, if you look at the testimony, they're saying, I wasn't lying. I didn't know when they said the name, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the military judge that conducted the debate hearing also thought that the person was not lying, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And since this was a debate hearing, I'm assuming then that the debate proceeding went back to the convening authority before it went up to the lower court, correct?
Yes, sir.
And none of those people, and the court, the lower court, thought that it was sufficient, right?
That's correct. The lower court adopted the findings and conclusions of law as their own, the Dubai military judges, findings and conclusions of law.
Okay, so we have three individuals and a lower court, but this court is supposed to decide that they're all wrong?
Yes, correct, Your Honor.
And because, exactly why?
Why? It's because, first and foremost, the name Ahmad Alvage is a very uncommon name.
Hang on. Go back. What do you need to demonstrate to get a new trial? Do you have to demonstrate that he lied? Is that the standard?
The standard is that he failed to answer honestly a material question of fact on voir dire, and that in doing so, in that failure to disclose that question or answer that question honestly, a challenge for cause would have been granted.
But underlying that, don't you have to show that the military judge's findings were clearly erroneous?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Is a mistaken recollection the same as a dishonest recollection?
No, it is not, Your Honor. A mistaken recollection would appear to have no malice or hidden agenda behind it. But it's the appellant's contention that the appellant, first and foremost, did lie and was actually biased.
Leaving aside whether he lied on voir dire, when he saw Ahmad enter the courtroom, did he have a duty to disclose, an independent duty, independent of voir dire, to disclose that he knew the guy?
Absolutely, and that is one of the military judge's findings that appellant does not take issue with. There was a duty of candor, and that is, to be honest and forthright with the court. throughout the voir dire process when answering the questions, and that continues through the entire trial.
Can you go through the can you go through the debate hearing findings then and tell us what's right and what's wrong? You don't have to do every word, but focus us on what you would hopefully discuss when we discuss this.
Appellant takes issue with all of the four major findings that's listed in paragraph 8, A, B, C, and D. We find that he did lie, he did fail to disclose, and he knew that name. It was very common to him. And the reason so, the only issue we do not take issue with in the debate findings is that the judge correctly stated that Major Melcher did have an ongoing duty, as all panel members do, to be candid and disclose.
Well, counsel, let's focus on that. Suppose that we determine we're not going to overturn the judge on the question. The judge wasn't clearly erroneous on the question of lying, that a person in this situation might not remember, irrespective of the uniqueness of the name. So what's your argument under the facts of this case with respect to the duty that the member owed at that point, and whether it was error, and if error, whether it was prejudicial?
Yes, Your Honor. If this court is not going to find actual bias exists, this court should still find that implied bias exists under the less deferential standard. The duty that exists at that time is Major Melcher, once he recognized Imad walked in, into the courtroom, he knew there was a prior working relationship, and that working relationship was extremely hostile between the two. He had a duty to disclose that to the court, and then we would have had a voir dire process.
Does it matter whether it was hostile or not from your standpoint?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. The hostility only leads more credence to his duty to disclose to the court.
What if he wasn't hostile? He said, gee, I thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Doesn't he have a duty to disclose that as well?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because that's a possible basis that perhaps the government would want to explore.
If we come down on your side in this case, what do you want us to do? Do you want a new trial?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay.
This court should set aside the Army Court's decision and remand the case for a re-hearing. The public, under an implied bias standard, which is objective and less deference is given to the military judge, would have believed that Major Melcher was biased. We have a consistent attitude of hostility, ranging from May 1999 to October 99. We have widely distributed and disseminated emails from Major Melcher regarding Imad al-Baj, in which he questions Imad al-Baj's honesty, professionalism, and motivation. These emails were neither thoughtless nor without reflection. And in fact, by the October 99 email, there was a perceived impact on command both in and outside of Fort Carson. And looking at the focus, which is on the appearance of fairness in the military justice system, this evidence of hostility between Major Melcher and Imad al-Baj would lead an objective outside observer to question Major Melcher's ability to sit in judgment of Imad al-Baj, first and foremost as a witness, and also of Imad's brother, who is the appellant in this case. Participation of such a questionable member would cause the public to doubt the process. And looking under the implied bias standard, many of the same bases exist under the actual bias standard. It's our contention that when the name was read, Imad, in the group voir dire question, that was a very uncommon name in the English language, yet it was a very common name for Major Melcher. This is based on his working relationship with...
How do you answer the government's question that the judge badly phrased the voir dire question and asked the name Imad in the context of the specifications where, of course, it didn't appear?
That may be true, Your Honor. However, the name Imad was still there, and we have a very hostile working relationship between Major Melcher and Imad al-Baj. The name Imad alone should have been enough to trigger in his mind, yes, that's potentially somebody I know. Let me raise my hand and get that down on the record in my duty of candor to the court.
Counsel, you keep arguing that there is all this evidence of hostility, and I understand that in looking at the emails, you can at least make that argument, but we're still faced with the military judge's finding that Major Melcher never had any hostile feelings toward this guy.
Under an actual bias standard, if this court finds that the military judge was not clearly erroneous, the same basis for arguments under actual bias exist under applied bias.
So are you arguing that even if we were to accept all of the military judge's findings, we can still find implied bias?
Yes, you can, Your Honor.
And that's based on what?
Based on hostile working relationship, the testimony of Umar Abbas, the evidence of this hostile working relationship, which exists at least from May to October 1999, and also the testimony of Umar Abbas's co-workers at the debate hearing. Mr. Gluck, his...
Judge Erdman asked, though, if you accept all of the judge's findings.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. But
if you accept all the judge's findings, can one still find implied bias? I think that was the question.
Yes, Your Honor. One could still find implied bias because the objective outside observer viewing this trial would have serious doubts as to whether or not, first and foremost, Major Melcher's disclosure, failure to disclose that he knew the name Imad Omaj was innocent, and likewise when he, Imad Abbas, took the stand and walked into the courtroom, that his failure to disclose at that time was likewise innocent. The objective member of the public would question
Let me ask this. When we're looking at implied bias and we're looking at the record, are we stuck with the facts that the military judge found, or can we look at the entire record and say, okay, a member of the public looking at the entire record of the trial is going to walk away from this trial holding their nose? Or do we say a member of the public who reads the military judge's debate findings is going to be upset? Which universe are we in here?
It is actually both, Your Honor. It's whether or not a panel member sitting in there would feel they would be biased or not. But it's also an even broader scope. It's the outside observer looking through that subject.
But what is the outside observer looking at? The entire trial proceeding?
The entire trial proceedings, including the emails and the testimony of the Dubay. Yes, Your Honor.
Do you think that it's significant at all that the major spelled Ahmad's name differently than it's actually spelled? And do you think that there's a reasonable possibility that it was pronounced differently by the military judge than Major Melcher perhaps thought it was pronounced? Or is that not possible?
It's from the record we know that a common nickname Ahmad had was Ed among his co-workers. However, Major Melcher very explicitly in his final email in October went out of his way to spell E-M-A-D or E-M-A-D.
So he was known as Ed?
That's correct.
People referred to him as Ed?
Those close to him, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And the disinterested observer or member of the public, do you think that would they also be able to consider the fact that despite this allegedly hostile environment, that Ed or Ahmad never brought it to anyone's attention that, hey, that's a guy that you know, I've had a lot of problems with sitting there on my brother's court-martial panel?
No, Your Honor, because we're imparting a similar duty upon a witness in a trial as the duty to speak the truth.
I'm not suggesting that the witness has a duty. I'm just suggesting that it's one of the facts and circumstances that we do have in this case, which is, as a practical matter, you're sitting there as a witness at a court-martial, your brother is on trial, and you look over at the court-martial member panels, and you see someone that, you know, you say 3 years later is very hostile to you and that you have big problems with. Do you think that has any bearing on this matter at all?
It does, but very little in light of the objective evidence in this case. One of the reasons proffered by Imad Abbas why he didn't come forward at that time is because he was sequestered, as all witnesses should be during the trial. He didn't know whom we should talk to disclose this, and he also didn't know the workings of the court-martial system as to whether or not he should disclose this. When he saw Major Melcher sitting on the panel, he was assumed that the matters had been resolved and that he should properly be there, and that's a fair assumption that the general public would make.
Is that in the record, or is that under how you interpret the record?
That is in the record in the debate in the Imad's testimony. If there are no further questions, I'll see the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Your Honor. Yes, may it please the court. My name is Captain Trevor Nelson, and along with Colonel John Miller II, we represent the government in this case. This court should affirm the findings and sentence because Major Melcher provided honest and candid answers during the process. In addition, the military judge found that there was no bad faith on behalf of Major Melcher during the Verbeer hearing.
Well, now, is bad faith the standard that we use here? I mean, doesn't a potential panel member have an ongoing duty? It doesn't matter. Does it matter whether or not he did it in good faith, bad faith, or any faith? The fact is that if something came up, doesn't he have a duty to disclose it to the military judge?
Well, for a valid cause of cause challenge to exist, the panel member answered must be dishonest, not merely mistaken. So bad faith comes with respect to whether or not there was any actual bias on behalf of Major Melcher. Did he recognize the name and somehow...
No, I'm talking about later on when Imad came into the courtroom and he recognized him. At that point, he knew it. And that's what the military judge found, that there was no bad faith on the part of Major Melcher in not disclosing that. And my question is bad faith the standard that we look at? Do we look at the subjective intent of the panel member, or is that something for the military judge to decide?
Well, no, we have to look at it both subjectively and objectively. Here we're looking to see whether or not there was any actual bias, and so that would be subjective with respect to Major Melcher, how he actually felt towards his witness, the appellant's brother, and then also objectively from a standpoint of the neutral observer from the public having the total information that the military judge would have had at the Dubay hearing to determine whether or not Major Melcher was indeed biased against appellant's witness.
But do you agree with the military judge's finding that Major Melcher had an ongoing duty in regard to the Dubay question?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And when he didn't fulfill that duty, when Imad came into the courtroom, what is the standard that we look at there? I mean, the fact that he didn't fulfill it, I mean, obviously means that he didn't fulfill the duty. Do we worry about what he was thinking about at that point?
Well, you know, we have to look at whether or not his answer was an honest answer. And even after the fact, where the witness walks in the courtroom, was his answer that they did not recognize his name initially, did that continue to be an honest answer even at that point? And the answer here is yes. What Major Melcher testified to the debate here is that he simply did not recall. That name just did not ring a bell.
Right, but there came a point, whether you agree with that or not, whether you think it's clearly erroneous that the name Imad did not ring a bell with him. Putting that aside, there came a point where the witness acknowledges that he knew who he was.
Correct, Your Honor.
And your response to Judge Erdman, I believe, was that you agree that he had an ongoing duty to indicate whether he knew the person.
Right, because at that point...
There came a point where he knew the person, and you concede that.
Correct, Your Honor.
Why was it honest then, or dishonest, to continue along without saying anything?
Because Major Melcher testified on that. He did not have any animosity or ill feeling.
What's that have to do with honesty? Either he knew him or he didn't know him. The question wasn't, tell me if you know someone named Imad only if you don't like him.
Right, Your Honor.
That doesn't go to honesty. That goes to what his feelings are about the person.
Well, it goes to honesty with respect to whether his answer was an honest answer initially when he was asked the question.
The judges are not asking about his initial answer. The judges are focusing on his duty at the time that he recognized the individual was in there. And Judge Baker's question was, what difference does it make if he thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread at that time? Didn't he have a duty to tell the member, the court marshal, I know him? And at that point, he would have explained how he knew him, and the defense counsel and the trial counsel would have looked at all the information. Let's assume that everything that he said was true and that everything that the military judge in the Dubay found was correct. What we have here is an individual who said about a fellow soldier that he talks about things being skewed, he gives answers that are not based on the fact or the truth. He is causing a tremendous amount of time being wasted. Everything he says is not true, not true, not true, not true. It's BS. Then he says later on, well, I thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Why isn't that a valid challenge for cause at that time, for the defense to be able to say, oh, he may think that he's great now, but he had this tremendous negative feeling about him before? Even if the judge is correct, it wasn't hostile, whatever that may mean, why isn't the defense entitled to remove that person from the court-martial when he has said all these negative things about the witness? Why shouldn't the court-martial proceed without that person being present?
Well, you know, as the military judge found from the debate here, that this would not have amounted to a valid exercise for a cause challenge. So, and it's the same military judge who sat through the court-martial proceedings. And this is the same information that you would have heard if Major Melcher had indicated to the military judge when he observed Mr. Emmett Albert.
So why wouldn't he be saying he's wrong as a matter of law then, assuming that it was a professional and not a personal disagreement? When a member of a court-martial has a professional disagreement that has escalated to language that appears to be language that soldiers don't normally use when talking about each other, that person should not be sitting there as a judge of the credibility of that witness, even if the member now says, well, I think he's great.
Well, you know, a professional relationship between a panel member and a participant and a court-martial is not a basis, is not an automatic basis for a cause.
Weren't these emails, didn't these emails go beyond professional disagreement? Didn't they get to be nasty and personal?
Well, Your Honor, Major Melcher testified that he did not have a personal conflict with Mr. Albash, Emmett Albash. It was really subordinates. They were being challenged as to whether or not this network system should be done in the way that...
Well, but the Major took it upon himself to call him a liar repeatedly.
Well, Your Honor, he was making reference with respect to the specifications that Mr. Albash put out to Lockheed Martin as to how doing where Major Melcher was.
Well, if one has a professional disagreement over a contracting issue, one does not necessarily have to call the one person with whom one has the disagreement a liar.
Well, Your Honor, I believe Major Melcher's testimony was that the specifications, how is it that Mr. Albers was described in the position of doing was incorrect. I admit that Mr. Melcher was probably upset about it because it went outside of...
Given the context, given what he said about Imad, and given the fact that he did not find it necessary when Imad walked into the courtroom to disclose this relationship, why shouldn't we find that the debate was clearly erroneous?
Well, because the professional, just because of the professional relationship between Major Melcher and a participant is not a basis for a cause challenge. And then secondly, what Major Melcher testified to, this disagreement took place between the summer...
He had a duty to speak and he didn't.
Right, and his explanation, Your Honor, was that I didn't believe at that time that he was saying to the military judge because I had no ill will towards Mr. Albash.
But that's, as was pointed out earlier, that's not what the judge asked. That's not what his duty was. His duty was not to speak if he doesn't like the guy. His duty was to speak.
Well, I mean, know now what Major Melcher would have said if he had spoken up at that particular point. What he said was exactly what he told the military judge during the debate hearing. And the question now is whether or not that would have formed a basis for a causal challenge. And the military judge found from the debate hearing that it would not.
We can agree that the record reflects that there was a time when Major Melcher thought that Imad was a liar.
Can you repeat that question for me, Your Honor?
Was there a time when Major Melcher thought that Imad, the brother, was dishonest or a liar?
Major Melcher did not testify to that, Your Honor.
Does the record reflect that?
The record does not reflect that, Your Honor. There are emails that was put into evidence in the debate hearing that indicate that Major Melcher called Mr. Albash a liar.
Okay, I'm happy with that. Is there documentary evidence in the Dubé record that indicates that Major Melcher referred to Imad as a liar? Yes, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Was this a case where the appellant's Imad's brother was on trial?
Yes, sir.
And was the brother, was the defendant's credibility at issue?
No, Your Honor. He testified.
So he wasn't defending on the grounds that it didn't happen. He was admitting everything happened.
Yes, Your Honor. And essentially, his
defendant pled guilty in this case?
No, Your Honor. Okay. He pled not guilty. But the brother, Imad, testified only to foundational.
I'm not asking about what Imad testified to. I'm asking if the defendant's credibility was at issue because he said it didn't happen.
Yes, Your Honor. His credibility was at issue. But Imad's credibility was not at issue. He testified only as a foundational witness to lay a foundation for the mission of a videotape.
So one's view of one's brother may have no possible bearing on one's view of somebody else's honesty, of the brother's honesty.
Well, no, the government in their position is that. This is attenuated. We're not talking about here where Mr. Emmett Alvarez was actually on trial, and there was a conflict between Major Melcher and Emmett Alvarez. We're talking here about the brother of a witness.
Didn't Emmett testify at sentencing?
He did testify at sentencing, Your Honor.
And certainly wouldn't the members take his credibility into account during that testimony?
Yeah, sure, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Did the military judge at any point say that, reach any conclusion as to whether these emails were sent?
Yes, Your Honor.
They were all sent.
Yes, Your Honor. The military judge accepted their testimony from some of the witnesses who received those emails, essentially that they did in fact receive those from.
And as I understand the military judge's findings, he found that there was no hostility or animosity expressed in those emails.
He found that there's overall, in totality of circumstances, there's really no animosity between Major Melcher and Emmett Alves at the time at the court martial. He acknowledges that there may have been some professional disagreement with respect to the project they were working on prior to the court martial, but at the time of the court martial, there was no disagreement. And Major Melcher, in fact, said that he held Mr. Emmett Alves in high regard because, in fact, he changed his position in terms of what Mr. Alves was proposing and agreed with Mr. Alves in the long run. That he was correct, and Major Melcher's expert was, in fact, wrong. So he came to trust Mr. Alves' judgment and did not have any animosity prior or at the time of trial.
And in your view, then, that there'd be no basis for a challenge for cause under that circumstance because a change in view is permanent? That is, that once a negative view once held that now becomes positive is something that's simply not grounds for challenge for cause?
Well, Your Honor, the government does not accept the proposition that Major Alves had a negative view of Major Melcher had a negative view of Mr. Alves. What we are saying is that there's a professional disagreement. Major Melcher came to accept Mr. Alves' position eventually, and as a result of that, he held him in high regard by the time of his brother's trial. So he may have well been a favorable, if the questions was asked during the voir dire process, Major Melcher may have well given very favorable answers, as he did here in the debate hearing. I would suggest that defense counsel would have wanted to have Major Melcher on the panel.
Isn't that defense counsel's call at that point to make an argument and persuade the military judge as to whether on those facts someone should or should not be disqualified?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how do we review that determination? Is that de novo?
That would be an abuse of discretion, Your Honor.
Abuse of discretion.
Now, and given also that we are past the point where presentation of evidence had begun, there would be no basis for appellant to have a parental challenge to Major Melcher, if in fact Major Melcher had made this disclosure at a point where he recognized appellant's brother. So there's no prejudice because he could not have exercised a parental challenge even at that point. And the judge found from the debate hearing that there was not a valid basis for a cause challenge.
So what case stands for the proposition that a professional disagreement does not constitute bias for purposes of cause?
Yeah, on that basis, we point of court attention to U.S. v. Warden, 51 MJ, 778. And even if major, even if it's a matter of favorable opinion, I've been rendered with respect to Mr. Alba's wouldn't have made a difference in this case. Whether that was a favorable or unfavorable, the analysis would essentially be the same.
Doesn't the record here, and as established by the military judge, show that there was a mixed opinion that changed over time?
A mixed?
That there was negative professional opinion, and now he says, I have a high regard for them. Isn't that the established record? That is, the record doesn't show a high opinion throughout, does it?
He had a negative opinion with respect to the decision that Mr. Albers made in terms of contacting the outside contractors. However, the panel would testify that he never had a hostile intent or feeling towards Mr. Albers. But in the end, since he agreed with his position, yes, he had a high regard for him professionally after the fact. And it's also indicated, too, from the record, that this disagreement was not directly between Mr. Albaj and Major Melcher, but it was with Major Melcher's subordinate. So he was listening to his subordinates when he began to form his opinion. But by the end of the project, when he was in more contact with what Mr. Albaj was doing, he had developed a favorable opinion of Mr. Albaj at that particular point. If there are no further questions, I'll briefly conclude. This court should affirm the Army Corps' finding because Major Melcher provided honest and candid answers during the voir dire process. There was no bad faith on his behalf of the military judge following the debate hearing. There was no basis for a valid cost challenge either. And that the lack of his disclosure to the military judge at the point he recognized Mr. Albers did not form a basis that would prejudice the appellant rights to a fair trial.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the defense, do you have a rebuttal?
The injustice in this case is that a panel member, not the military judge, made the decision whether or not he was biased against Imad Albaj. Members of the court, this is not a case where the panel member simply fails to disclose a prior working relationship with a defense witness. Rather, the objective evidence shows a prior hostile work environment between Major Melcher and Imad Albaj spanning at least 6 months. And this alone is sufficient to raise the specter of implied bias, if not actual bias itself. Accordingly, appellant respectfully requests that this court set aside the lower court's decision and remand the case for a rehearing.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. That concludes this week's cases, and the court will stand in recess until next Monday morning at 9 o'clock.
The court stands adjourned until